It is Monday, March 28th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, we'll have the latest on a shooting incident in the U.S. Capitol, just blocks from Voice of America's headquarters. A reporter with VOA's DIWA service tells us how Pakistan's government is responding to Sunday's suicide bombing that killed more than 70 people in Lahore. U.S. Democratic presidential contender Bernie Sanders is on a roll. Our national correspondent explains why. And our correspondent in Los Angeles takes a ride on a brand new virtual reality roller coaster.
You can look all around you. You're completely surrounded by this world. Wow, that was quite an experience.
It's all ahead on International Edition. Authorities in Washington have detained a lone gunman who pointed his weapon at police inside a visitor center of the U.S. Capitol and caused the whole complex to be put on a temporary lockdown. It's a busy week for tourists here, many of whom have come to see the world-renowned cherry blossoms that are now in full bloom around the nation's capital. I spoke a short time ago to our congressional correspondent, Cindy Sain, and I asked her what we know about the shooting incident.
Well, there was an incident at the U.S. Capitol, and multiple sources are saying that it was a suspect by the name of Larry Dawson, who was already known to U.S. Capitol Police, who came in the visitor center and presented a gun. And then Capitol Police fired shots at him, and another woman was injured, we believe, by shrapnel from this incident.
Tell us where you were as this event was unfolding and what you saw and heard.
We got word and then walked up Capitol Hill and got as close as we could. Police were already there with strong presence, machine guns, and had taped off the area. But we did get to interview some families. I spoke to a woman whose husband and child were inside, and luckily she was able to text with them and they were okay. But she was getting ready to go in and was told by police to run away. So she ran away. Her husband and child were told to go in the theater inside the Capitol Visitor Center, and the husband said he believed he heard an entire clip fired, which was apparently Capitol Police then who were firing. But of course, this woman was very shaken up. She was from Ohio, here as a tourist, and didn't expect to have something like this happen.
And it was happening in the Capitol Visitor Center. Can you explain briefly what that center is?
Yes, after previous shootings, they made it a little more difficult for the general public to get into the U.S. Capitol. So it's an underground area, which is separated by a large area, about a block from the actual Capitol building.
How significant would you say this incident is, you know, happening at a time when, you know, many people are concerned about security around the world?
Yes, well, this is a time where people are on high alert. Not only the entire Capitol complex, the Supreme Court was put on lockdown, the White House. After the Brussels attacks happening just a few days ago, people are very upset. And the fact that someone had a gun in the U.S. Capitol is a serious incident.
Well, I think we're all glad that it wasn't worse. But thank you very much to our House correspondent, Cindy Sain, for bringing us that report.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn to our social media segment. And G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio for online reaction to that top story. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So what are you hearing on Facebook?
So many people are closely following the Washington Metropolitan Police Department's Facebook page. That account wrote this about 2 hours ago. There has been an isolated incident at the U.S. Capitol. There is no active threat to the public. Now, a comment with the most number of likes reads like this. Great job. Thank you for keeping our Capitol safe. I wish people were checked before they enter the Capitol instead of while they enter. Not a very useful security strategy in the 21st century. It could backfire. Very dangerous. Now, most of the replies were thanking the police force, and also the Wall Street Journal tweeted a correction less than an hour ago. Apparently, no officer got hurt in the Capitol gunfire, contrary to initial reports.
That's some good news, G. Mm-hmm. So the Capitol building, it wasn't the only complex in this area to be shut down temporarily today, right?
Exactly. So there was also a separate incident at the White House, but the lockdown there was also quickly lifted after the person who tried to jump over the fence was taken into custody.
Some coincidence, huh?
I know. And under CNN's Facebook post about the incident, many people shared frustration with the mainstream media's coverage of it. Here's an example. Even though it's an isolated incident, expect CNN to devote a full day of coverage of this and link it back to terrorism in order to get higher ratings. Well,
it's been at least a couple of hours of coverage so far.
I know, yeah. And it's very recent, too. So I suppose we can say many on social media believe both incidents in D.C. are pretty much isolated incidents.
Good to hear. Well, what else is trending on Twitter today?
A hashtag about Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders is also trending. It's hashtag Bernie made me white. That hashtag came on the back of media coverage, especially from CNN, of Sanders' caucus wins in Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington over the weekend. It was a huge win for him, as you know, or should I say huge. His supporters feel that the mainstream media coverage of depicting these states as having low minority populations is inaccurate. I don't know if you've seen some of these photos, but if you search under that hashtag, you'll find pictures of Sikh, African-American, and Native American supporters of Sanders, among other ethnic groups, of course. Michael?
Right, so they're not all white, are they?
No.
Well, thanks very much, G, for that wrap-up. You can follow G on Twitter at GAbbyLee, and you can also find this show at VOA_IE. Well, let's move on to other news. Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has vowed to intensify counterterrorism operations in response to Sunday's deadly suicide bombing in the eastern city of Lahore, targeting Christians. The attack killed at least 72 people, including about 30 children, and wounded 300 others in a crowded park. VOA Diwa Service reporter Iftikhar Hussain, who's based here in Washington, has been following the aftermath of that attack. When I spoke with him today, I asked him whether the Pakistani government has been doing much to fight the Islamist militant group that said it was behind the bombing.
Well, this is a very basic and a fundamental question. The Pakistan military is fighting Tehreek-e-Taliban in the North Waziristan operation, but we have not seen, they say, we are without any discrimination fighting against each and every group in the region. But Pakistan's security establishment and the Pakistan state has long been accused of separating good and bad Taliban, and that refers to somebody fighting in Kashmir against India can be a good Taliban, and again, somebody fighting against foreign troops in Afghanistan can be a good Taliban, but somebody who is attacking inside can be a bad Taliban.
But what about this particular faction of the Taliban that claim responsibility for this attack? Are they considered good or bad Taliban, and by who?
We have not heard anything specifically that they are good or bad, but the operation carried out seems they have not been weakened in the tribal region, and Lahore is considered the heart of Pakistan. It was the strike was carried out in the heart of Pakistan. That means it has the striking capabilities. It are intact. They can carry out suicide bombings. Their outreach has not been affected. So that means the Pakistan strategy so far, just to attack Taliban only in the tribal region, has not worked.
What is the reaction of the Pakistan's Christian minority to this attack, which targeted them?
The Christian minorities in Pakistan, if you look into the timeline, the very recent timeline, they have been attacked. And we see in Lahore also a church was attacked previously last year. And again, a couple was under blasphemy charges burned. And in 2013, September, a church was attacked in Peshawar. They have been the victims. They have been the target. We talked to the representatives, Peshawar Bishop Sarfaraz Humphrey. He told VOA Diwa that 7,000 Christian families have left Pakistan due to insecurity to Thailand. And again, we have talked to another leader from Balochistan. He told us that why we. So the minorities, and especially the Christians, feel very insecure in Pakistan, given the facts that they are under attack by sectarian and terrorist organization.
And what do Pakistanis in general think about the fact that in this particular attack, more Muslims were killed than Christians?
Well, it's not the question of who is killed. Terrorist ideology does not discriminate, but still, there is a point when Jamaatul Ahrar claimed the responsibility for the attack. They very specifically told the media that the attack, the target were Christians. So it takes us to the argument that Christians or any other minority, if they are Sikhs, if they are Hindus in Pakistan, they are under attack. The state has a responsibility. If a civilian, a Sunni or a Shia or a Hindu or Sikh or anybody is killed there.
Well, thank you to VOA Dewa international broadcaster Iftikhar Hussain for bringing us that information.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
A slow-moving loris missing all of its teeth, parrots with disabled wings, malnourished primates, wild animals who can no longer survive on their own, all share a 1.3-hectare home in Indonesia. Dharma Jaya Sukmana is with Indonesia's Animal Sanctuary Trust.
The sanctuary was founded to show our care for wild animals that, as we know, often live under threats including illegal wildlife trade, loss of habitat, and forest fires.
Despite strict international laws against wildlife trafficking, the nonprofit group Profauna says there was nearly a 70% increase in recorded cases of the illegal wildlife trade between 2014 and 2015. Sanctuaries like Bogor try to rehabilitate as many animals as possible to return to the wild, but some, like the loris, can never return. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Well, as Giabi Lee and I were discussing a bit earlier in the show, U.S. Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders is starting the week on a high note. He won caucuses for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination in three states on Saturday, that is, Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington, beating his rival Hillary Clinton by massive margins. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone is following the election campaign for us. I sat down with him and wanted to know how much of a boost Sanders is getting from his latest victories.
Well, it's a much-needed boost for Bernie Sanders in this regard, that over the last few weeks, with some big Clinton victories in some of the larger states like Ohio and Florida, Sanders needed to show he was still relevant and needed to show that he could demonstrate he could stay in the race. And I think these victories, albeit in smaller voting electorates in these states, shows that Bernie Sanders and the appeal he has is very much alive in the Democratic Party. It's not going away. Now, what is his path to the nomination? Well, it's quite steep because he would have to win the remaining contest by quite a high figure in terms of percentages as Democrats allocate the delegates. But he's still relevant to the debate. And now I think the onus is a bit more on Hillary Clinton to somehow make the final closing case why Sanders has had a good campaign, but why he needs to close it out. His victories on Saturday, you know, kind of bought him more time, I think, to compete in some of the upcoming states, especially Wisconsin next week and beyond, say, New York and Pennsylvania.
Well, how do you think Bernie Sanders is going to do in those upcoming states?
Well, I think he's competitive, say, in Wisconsin, which votes on April 5th. He tends to do well in states that have a large proportion of progressive voters, liberal voters, among the Democrats who go to the polls. He tends to do well in states where the minority population is actually kind of lower. His core group is progressive whites, and he's done very well with younger people.
And why is it that minority Americans, blacks, Hispanics, are not so taken with his message as they are with Hillary Clinton?
I think there's a familiarity with Hillary Clinton that helps her a great deal based on her husband's presidency, the fact that they've been involved with civil rights groups for a few decades. It's not that Bernie Sanders hasn't supported those movements or those groups, but maybe he wasn't as visible as Bill and Hillary Clinton. So there's a longer kind of track record and link for those groups with the Clinton campaign, and she has really used it to her advantage, especially in those southern states with high African-American populations.
How concerned do you think Hillary Clinton's camp is about how Bernie Sanders has put together a series of primary and caucus wins now?
They want, the Clinton people, meaning they, want this to be over as soon as possible. Why? She thinks she is pretty much on track for the nomination. She wants to focus on the Republicans, particularly Donald Trump. The longer she has to contend with the challenge from Bernie Sanders and his energized followers, I mean, they're going to see it as a bit of a distraction. And she's got to be careful to not in any way disrespect what's going on there, because if she is to become the nominee, she's going to have to bound the whole party up and heal it together so they can have an effective campaign in the general campaign. So it's a very tricky balance here between realizing the kind of challenge Sanders presents and not antagonizing any of his followers.
Or wanting to alienate them. Yeah, she wants them on board. Well, thank you very much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone, for bringing us the latest from the election.
My pleasure, Michael.
Well, on the Republican side of the election, real estate tycoon Donald Trump remains the frontrunner for the Republican presidential nomination. The prospect of someone who has no prior experience in politics winning the U.S. presidency is making some U.S. investors uncomfortable. Taylor Tepper is a writer with Money Magazine in New York. I asked him how Wall Street is reacting to the Trump phenomenon.
I know people are freaking out. Some people are freaking out, some people are very happy. Investors are really nervous, and you're coming out with these think pieces about how Trump is going to ruin the stock market and everyone's going to sell and everything's going to be terrible, which may happen, but no one knows what's going to happen. And I wrote a piece about this not too long ago, and the general thrust of that was that anyone who says that they know what the stock market's going to do over a particular period of time in the near future just is lying to you.
Well, they're just speculating, right?
Or speculating is, I guess, a nicer way to put it. And, yeah, the stock market is a forward-looking gauge. It sort of tests sentiment. And, I mean, this is very, very short-term, but since Trump has been winning primaries and caucuses, the stock market's gone up. So in and of itself, I don't think there's any real reason that investors have to fear that a Trump presidency in and of itself will cause stocks to decline. And even if some of his sort of out there proposals become policies, there's no magic algorithm or formula that says doing some of the controversial things that he wants to do will cause stocks to go one way or the other.
Well, what do you think of some of those controversial policies? I mean, the people who are predicting a market crash are saying, well, Donald Trump is promising huge tax cuts that would leave the federal government with much less revenue, and he's also promising big spending increases on things like defense and homeland security, and also predicting that that would balloon the size of the U.S. deficit. So shouldn't people be concerned about that when they think about investing?
So people should not be concerned about that when they think about investing for a couple reasons. The first thing is that all of those positions are wildly unpopular and are very unlikely to happen. The government can't confirm a moderate Supreme Court justice. I don't think that the government is going to be able to come up with legislation that will deport 11 million people, number one. Number two, when investors invest their politics, when investors get into the habit of mixing, you know, how they feel about certain issues with their long-term wealth, they get into trouble. The point of having a sustainable and having a fully funded retirement, the way you have to do that is staying in the market for a long time. And if you get freaked out and just start selling because Trump gets the nomination or wins the election, you're going to hurt your long-term wealth. So I just think that people would be much better off sort of putting their fears to the side. You know, if they're very afraid about a Trump presidency for its implications for what it's going to do to people's lives, by all means, go out there and protest and vote for someone else. But don't use your investment as a proxy for that.
Thanks a lot for that market analysis from Taylor Tepper, a writer with Money Magazine in New York.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
In a number of studies, researchers have outlined the health dangers of sitting too much and its link to the onset of some chronic diseases and early death. Now, a new report in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine suggests sitting for more than 3 hours a day is to blame for 3.8% of all worldwide deaths. The study authors also found that moderate or even vigorous physical exercise might not be enough to offset the negative effects of sitting for too long. They suggest that reducing daily sitting time to less than 3 hours a day could add an average of 0.2 years to a person's life expectancy. The researchers say the link between sitting and death was highest in Western Pacific nations, followed by European, Eastern Mediterranean, American, and then Southeast Asian countries. Lately, more office workers are using workstations that allow them to alternate between sitting and standing throughout the day. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The next generation of roller coaster experience has arrived. Correspondent Elizabeth Lee checked out a new virtual reality roller coaster at a Los Angeles amusement park called Six Flags Magic Mountain and spoke to the ride's developer, Thomas Wagner. Here's what she found out.
On this clear morning, Jesse Cotton and his mother are ready to experience the unknown.
It was exciting. I'm telling you, you could see the buildings, you were firing at these, you were firing missiles. It's exciting.
Because you're wearing goggles, you can't see the track. You don't know what's about to come.
Cotton is about to ride the roller coaster again. He's one of the first people to experience a virtual reality roller coaster. It's a traditional ride that is transformed when riders put on Samsung's Gear VR headset. It's a Samsung phone paired with virtual reality goggles. There is a box on the roller coaster that maps the ride. It knows exactly the position of the ride and sends a Bluetooth signal to the rider's headset, resulting in what the person sees.
For every coaster, we have to figure out where do we place our black box that is transmitting the Bluetooth signal. Do we have a good reception in all of the seats?
The maker of this experience says not every type of roller coaster is a candidate for the virtual reality experience.
We had bad experience going on wooden coasters, for instance, for the vibration. So the headset would be vibrating, the electronics would be vibrating heavily, and that's not that good. But all the steel coasters of the world would be able to be equipped.
This roller coaster, called the New Revolution, is made of steel and takes riders on a journey to fight aliens from the sky in this virtual city.
You look down and everything's moving with you. Really felt like you're the pilot of this fighter jet. And you're definitely gonna jump out of your seat a few times.
So my plane is about to take off, and above me I see the sky and an entire city with skyscrapers around me and planes flying around me. Woo!
You can look all around you. You're completely surrounded by this world.
Wow, that was quite an experience. Nothing like I've ever experienced before.
Nine Six Flags parks in North America will be debuting virtual reality roller coasters this year, creating a completely new experience for thrill seekers. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Well, I hope that roller coaster makes its way to the Washington area sometime soon so that I can check it out. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Daryl Smith. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. You can find me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Radovan Karadzic, also known as the Butcher of Bosnia, was sentenced March 24th to 40 years in prison for genocide and other crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia Court in The Hague, Netherlands. The former leader of the breakaway Serbian Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina was found guilty of murder, persecution, forcible transfer, terror, and hostage-taking during the Bosnian War from 1992 to 1995, a conflict that's estimated to have taken more than 100,000 lives. Delivering the verdicts, presiding Judge Ogan Kwan said Karadzic had ordered detained Bosnian Muslim men from Srebrenica to be transferred for killing. It was part of a brutal campaign against Bosnian Muslims that came to be known as ethnic cleansing. In a statement issued March 24th, U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner noted, "With the trial chamber's conviction, we move one step closer to closing another painful chapter in the story of the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. We'll never forget the horrors of genocide in Bosnia or the many other crimes committed on all sides of the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. Nor will we ever stop honoring their victims and survivors. We urge the members of the international community to cooperate with the ICTY and respect its decisions."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.